This is CSAP Science and Policy Podcast, where we're bringing you the latest evidence and expertise to improve public policymaking. This week, we're proud to present a bonus episode on our food system in the context of COVID-19, which features content from our 2020 virtual annual conference.
Hi, I'm Rob Doubleday, Director of the Center for Science and Policy and host of CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast. Throughout September, we've been sharing bonus content from our 2020 annual conference. This week, we're delighted to be able to share with you an edited version of our session on food systems, which was recorded back in May. We are talking about food, food policy, and different ways of understanding the food system. The theme is food. We are interested in food as a policy question, food as a systemic issue that links with lots of other things that we care about and know about. And in that context, I'm extremely delighted to welcome our three panelists, Emily Miles, who is the Chief Executive of the Food Standards Agency, Dame Teresa Marteau, who's a behavioural scientist and Director of the Behaviour and Health Research Unit at Cambridge, and Professor Dame Ottilien Leijzer. At the time of recording, Ottilien, a plant scientist, was Director of the Sainsbury Laboratory at Cambridge. By the time our podcast listeners hear this, however, Ottilien will have taken over as Chief Executive of the UKRI. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you all three. It's really lovely to hand over to Emily to start the discussion about food. Emily.
Thank you, Rob. Now, the topic today is the food strategy, and particularly, I think, in the light of a conversation that Henry Dimbleby had had with some Cambridge academics before Christmas about the national food strategy that he's working on. He's former founder of Leon. He's been a non-executive director for DEFRA. He's leading some work at the moment on food strategy. And I just wanted to recap what he's been saying, because I think it's useful as a framing for this conversation. So he says that the British food system, he describes it as miraculous. So it feeds cities, it provides 1 in 7 jobs, or at least it did until the 20th of March. It supports beautiful landscapes across the country. But it has been facing 3 big issues. And these are the ones that Henry was grappling with in his food strategy. So environmental degradation, sickness, so we were eating things that were making us unhealthy, and we have an obesity crisis in this country, and food security. And the thing he was particularly thinking about was in relation to climate crises. So, you know, what if you had 2 harvests, Russia and the US, in a row that failed? What would that mean for food security for this country? And I was listening to a talk he gave reflecting on COVID-19 and saying this crisis isn't every crisis. There are things about this crisis, which is about labour supply mainly, which will be different to, say, a climate crisis. But the framing I wanted to take for this conversation today was to think of COVID-19, which we've all been through in the last period, as a barium meal. So one of my colleagues, the Director of Strategy at the Food Standards Agency, Paul Morrison, has been saying for the last 4 or 5 weeks, it's like a barium meal we've all drunk as a country. And it's showing up where things are working and fine, where we're surprised at how much improvement and change we've managed to make in just a few weeks. And then it's also showing up the weaknesses in the system, where the defects are. And so my question at the moment is, what has COVID-19 taught us about the food system, which is relevant for Henry Dimbleby's food strategy? And I'll just offer you some initial observations, which I'm sure we will expand on in the course of this conversation. So, first thought, a clear common purpose can unite the country. I have never in my lifetime as a civil servant seen such an effect of a clear statement of purpose, the stay home, protect the NHS, save lives, some law that was backed in behind it, some financial support, all of the levers of the state being used, and largely and astonishingly people complying with that. So second of all, legitimacy for considerable state intervention when it's a life and death matter. So the amount of change we can expect when the stakes are really high. Henry was saying in this talk, he said, even in the Second World War, you could go to the pub, but we haven't been allowed to go to the pub. At the moment we have, I was trying to work it out this morning, possibly half of employees or people employed are paid for by the state. So we've got 8 million people furloughed. We've got 5.4 million people employed in the UK public sector. There were 33 million in employment in March. We haven't got stats out yet for the self-employed. Like the way that the role of state has changed in the last 8 weeks has been astonishing. Third observation, there was a shock to food supply. There was all the unexpected buying in March, could perhaps have been planned for. But the retailers recovered extremely quickly, there are a few shortages in flour and eggs and so on, which so the particular dependencies, but incredible response, particularly because retailers were suffering from their own staff absences, sometimes at 20% or above. So they were dealing with that amazing situation. Fourthly, I think some very impressive collaboration between the state and parts of the food industry. So if I look at how quickly DEFRA and the NHS and Public Health England, Bidford, Brakes, Fair Share got together and sorted out food parcels to the vulnerable and shared information, DEFRA passing details of clinically vulnerable to supermarkets so they could get priority access to slots. 250,000 parcels a week going out in April. Just the amount of, I look at what the civil service was doing in that situation, feel incredibly proud of them. But, and my fifth observation is, it was not organised to attend simultaneously to multiple outcomes. So that healthy, available, affordable, safe, environmentally sustainable food. Those are the things that Henry is talking about. And actually, I think our Barium meal has shown some shakiness in the system. So the food parcels went out, but they had no fresh veg in. They had fruit in, 5 apples, 5 oranges. Some of them got carrots in, but no fresh veg. So difficult. We've done calories, but perhaps not nutrition. Food security for vulnerable consumers has felt quite shaky at times. Scope did a survey saying 38% of disabled people didn't know how to get access to delivery slots. To where I was sitting, I could see we were well connected to industry, much harder to get the voice of the consumer, the vulnerable consumer, fed into our system. Those feedback loops you need in systems were not as active in that space. Thirdly, another food security one for young people. So FSA has just done a survey which we're soon to publish, which suggests 40% of 20 to 24 year olds worried about being able to afford food in the next month, compared to, I think it was an average of about 30% across all age groups. We had issues around social distancing at work, which we had to work through incredibly quickly with the food industry. And then the last one on my mind, which was tough, was we needed to operate some easements to our labelling policies at short notice because we had all this food going that was intended for the service sector that needed to come into retail and the labelling requirements are different. We were able to operate some easements in the end, but we had to work through 4 different governments in Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland and England to get those agreed. And you can imagine that that operating at speed with that kind of process is a bit challenging. So for me, what COVID-19 is telling us is that the food system is interconnected. Those outcomes are healthy, safe, environmentally sustainable and available are important to the consumer, but government, as ever, is not joined up in the right way. And I think this is more than just joining government up. What we've shown is that with a common purpose and a collective effort, government and the private sector and civil society can all play a part, which means we will have to behave differently too.
Now, Teresa, over to you.
Thanks, Emily, for asking a great question of what has COVID-19 taught us. And I think my answer to the question is not dissimilar to yours in that it has shone a light on the connected systems of which food is just one. And certainly for me, I think what it's done is it's broken some of the silos in thinking between infectious disease, non-communicable disease, and climate change. So to pick up just a couple of examples there. So we've seen the importance of tackling obesity in tackling COVID-19. We knew that tackling obesity was important in terms of stemming the tide of non-communicable diseases like cancer, diabetes. But what we've seen is that obesity increases the risk of severe COVID-19, and a rather stark statistic that of those dying in hospital in the UK, 1 in 4 have diabetes as opposed to 1 in 10 in the population. So it highlights the importance of tackling obesity for having a resilient population in the face of future pandemics. I think this pandemic has also highlighted the importance of environmental degradation, biodiversity loss in terms of diseases going from animals to humans, making the world more vulnerable, not just to this virus, but also to other pandemics. There are many causes, of course, of biodiversity loss, but some of it is about intensive agriculture, which includes intensive animal farming. So being able to shift food systems away from animals towards more plant-based systems is going to contribute there. The food system and any strategy for improving our food systems, both for, if you like, human health and planetary health, is going to involve interventions in many places in that system. As a behavioral scientist, I'm just going to say a little bit about some of the evidence for changing behavior across populations towards healthier and more sustainable diets, if you like, shifting some of the demand side, which of course will feed back into the supply side, before ending with a question. So the important thing is that there is no one intervention. We need lots of interventions and interventions in different parts of the systems. As a behavioral scientist, we know that less effective ways of shifting behavior across populations are those that depend on targeting conscious processes. So information-based interventions are less effective than ones that don't depend on conscious systems. So changing cues in our environment to enable the target behavior to make that more likely and the current behavior more difficult. So one of the largest effects that we've seen is from changing foods that are readily available, both for reducing energy intake and for tackling obesity, and reducing meat intake for tackling climate change. So we can increase selection of these healthier, more sustainable foods by increasing the proportion of the healthier, more sustainable foods, and this is a terribly important detail not to lose, reducing the proportion of the less healthy and less sustainable foods. So it's not just about adding more things into a system. It's about taking one lot out and substituting with another lot. So some of this can be done without regulation. In public sector environments, there is an opportunity that often isn't taken advantage of as much as it could be, and to ensure that the food that's offered is sustainable, both in terms of population health and planetary health. And I think we should be asking ourselves, should any food that's purchased out of the public purse stand a chance of undermining the health of the people and the planet that we inhabit? So I just want to end on a question about the policy actions that will be needed to shift the food system, both in terms of tackling obesity and shifting our diet in order to tackle climate change. And again, this echoes a question that Emily has asked, which is, are policymakers emboldened or are they deterred by massive state action following dealing with the pandemic? So does the scale of state action that we've seen in this pandemic make it more or less likely that policymakers will act on a similar scale, given that we've seen that they can do, to tackle food systems to address obesity and climate change? Related to that, how will the tension between wealth and health creation play out as we struggle our way out of a recession? There are powerful vested interests in the status quo in terms of the food system. And finally, what is the public appetite for state action to address this?
Great. Thank you so much, Teresa. I mean, there's a lot there. I mean, not least your discussion of what we know about from behavioral science about what can help shift diets, but probably also the bigger question about how to think holistically about food. But let's first hear from Ottilien.
This, I think, is a very interesting question about the food system that maps much more generally onto all kinds of complex systems that are really important to think of in that kind of systemic way. We've heard this quite a lot in the conversation so far. You're asking for a system, the food system in this case, to deliver many different things simultaneously. We've talked already about sustainability, part of which is climate change mitigation, but there's much broader issues to sustainability than that. And then, of course, health and how to encourage healthy eating, and then the complex relationships between the different parts of the system and what role government has to play in trying to organize that system. I think this whole concept of thinking about these things as complex, interconnected has moved on quite far in recent years, which is very exciting to see. There are things like the Eat Lancet report, and also I think the excellent work at DEFRA on the agricultural system that is trying hard to think more holistically about these systems, but it's difficult because they are complex. And I think the first thing that everybody has to do is resist the temptation to throw up your hands in horror and run away. It is a strong temptation, and it's a strong temptation that is driven by a number of things that are really very basic human ways of thinking about things, layered on top of, I think, a few decades of the way people think about policy and policy interventions, and also more generally about how to drive and manage change. And most of the way we like to think about things involves linear narratives. We like to think we're going to be able to intervene in some big way and trace that to the desired outcome that we'd like to see, and that the relationship between that intervention and the outcome is going to be pretty linear, so we'll be able to track those things over time and feel good about ourselves. There's a lot of interest in kind of smart objectives and how you do, you know, specific, measurable, attributable, all of these kinds of things. And systems just don't work that way. And you have to be able to step back from that very human way of thinking about things and instead think in terms of these complex, dynamical, multi-scale systems which are very feedback driven. We have a lot of tools to think about those systems, various different modeling approaches, including quite intuitive ones for people to use, like kind of agent-based systems, for example. And one can do one's best to think hard about these systems and to put in place the best tools you can to understand them, but you will be working in uncertainty. So based on those modelings and understandings, you then have to think about what interventions you might want to make. And indeed, those interventions are very likely to be a large number of small things rather than a small number of large things, which is traditionally the way we've tended to think about these things. And there will be no silver bullets. It will be lots of small things. And that's also kind of hard for people to deal with. And the relationship between those interventions and the changes in the systems might take some time. They probably won't be linear. You might see sudden transitions, for example. And again, that makes people nervous. So then you have another point in the process where you have to resist the temptation to throw up one's hand in horror and run away. And you have to do things. You have to have the courage to do things based on the best evidence that you have. And as I say, that's likely to be multiple things at once. And then you have to monitor, and see whether you think the system is responding in the way that you thought. And if not, that's new data, and you feed it back into your models and go round again. And here, if I'm going to refer to the pandemic, I think one of the things that's been interesting is watching decisions being made very rapidly, involving quite a lot of work and intervention and all the rest of it, in the context of uncertainty and insufficient data. And then watching those decisions be changed because new data comes in and you feed that back into the system. And in some ways, that's very encouraging that can work and people have been made to do it. But I must say, I've been rather concerned about the way the media and the public discourse around that uncertainty has unfolded. We are very deeply embedded in a kind of blame game where there must be one right thing to do. And if the government aren't doing it, it's terrible, rather than a recognition that there is no one right thing to do. And the decisions are being made in a moving landscape and that they will change. And we have to be used to the idea that a change in policy is not an admission of failure. It's an admission that the policy system is working by monitoring and reevaluating and retuning to get to a common desired goal. And I would echo that common desired goal is a really important part of the system to bring people together and allow these complex aspects to work together going forward. And that's something that I think we surely can learn from the crisis, that a powerful common desired outcome is a very good galvanizer. So I've talked very generally about systems then. How might this relate to the food system? So the part of the food system I know best is the agricultural production end as a plant scientist. And it has been very interesting to me over the years just to watch that part and the complexities associated with it. And they have to do with all of the things I listed at the beginning. You're trying to deliver multiple things at once out of the same system. You've got multiple actors. And a lot of the discussion about research and innovation in that sector is complicated by the fact that, unlike a lot of sectors where it works really well in many ways, like in big engineering or in big pharma, where it's very clear what the kind of value chain looks like. There are people making things that you sell, and those people are making the money and are therefore able to invest in the R&D system in a very active way. In the agricultural system, it's just not like that. So if I, you know, think I've discovered a way to apply fertilizer that allows you to use way less fertilizer, particularly in combination with this particular variety of cereal or whatever, how I really roll that out into fields is very difficult. The people who make money are, every farmer makes a small amount of money by being able to apply less fertilizer, but they have to invest their time in figuring out how to do this new system. Fertilizer companies lose money, we're selling less of it. And a lot of the benefits to that are environmental, and nobody in particular, but everybody in general benefits from those differences. And so how you construct that system, which of course is full of private sector players, and that's all well and good, to drive the kinds of changes one wants for public benefit is quite tricky. Getting the regulatory systems in place that are really joined up regulatory systems. And again, I think there is kind of hope on the horizon. I think the work done on the new agriculture bill, for example, is extremely interesting and promising. But how that then feeds down into regulation, I think, will be really important, particularly, for example, in the regulation of new plant varieties, where there's been a lot of focus. And it's that regulatory system is incredibly separate from any of these broader goals. It's very much focused on breeders protecting the rights to their varieties and getting them out into the field, usually on a relatively narrow range of well-established traits that farmers we know are interested in. So that's just a kind of tiny example of the kind of disconnection problems that there are that other people have talked about in the system. But I have some optimism that at least the challenges associated with system thinking are now being much more widely recognised in government, and there is beginning to be a change in allowing that to happen more. But try we accelerate that and make it work well is, I think, still a very big question. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ocelyn. There's a lot of ground covered and also quite a lot of questions now already being asked. I think I'll start, Emily, if you don't mind, by asking you to pick up a couple of the threads that Teresa and Ottoline introduced, really around the kind of the politics and the likelihood that we will have a political situation and a government that can, that will feel kind of empowered to act concertively in the public interest on food as a system, and at the same time, as Ottoline said, to act in a way that's in tune with the system-like nature of food. Whereas we know, as Ottoline said, many of us think in linear terms, and government, you know, is accountable and claims credit for achieving things, often in very linear terms. So that, I mean, I'm interested in your response to both Ottoline and Teresa.
It's my experience is it's harder to get the working across departments. It can happen, and the mechanisms for making it happen have been tried and tested over many years. You know, under Tony Blair, I was working in Downing Street when he did stock takes, and we'd have fortnightly or monthly meetings on a cross-system issue. We had targets at the Treasury sector, spending reviews. More recently, we've had joint ministers between departments. We have cabinet committees and so on. Basically, when the Prime Minister is interested, and where there is huge political will from the centre of government, collaboration does happen. And often that is informed by context. So if there's a really strong burning platform, like a terrorist attack that's just happened, or a war that we're going through, or a crisis like COVID-19, my God, the civil service knows how to pull itself together and deliver extraordinary things in extremely short spaces of time. I know that there will be lots and lots of critique of some of the things that we've done in the last few months, but focusing on some of the positives, you know, we set up a furlough scheme in less than a calendar month. We distributed £4 billion worth of taxpayers' money in 2 days flat. You know, that kind of thing takes, that's a huge amount of investment beforehand in lots of technology and systems and so on. And the thinking through that would have happened between several government departments to make that happen. You know, they established a school voucher scheme in 9 days. So it is possible for us to move, but it requires immense political will. And that political will has to be driven by a vision and has to be driven by a narrative. And that in turn is significantly informed by public opinion. So if the public opinion is we really need to save the NHS by getting on top of our obesity crisis because the NHS is something we massively care about, I think that in turn will give the impetus for ministers to act. In the same way, I think that the sense of climate crisis was informing ministers over the last 3 or 4 years with David Attenborough's stuff on plastics and then the climate strikes and so on. I think that changed the narrative and governments started going, OK, we really, really need to act here. So there's a symbiosis between public opinion and political action. But if there is political will and drive from the centre, things can change. But it needs those things.
You know, are there things that we can do to make systems thinking and systems working more likely, even when there isn't sort of the one clear top-down commitment to
act? Systems thinking requires such a different attitude. It is really difficult. So, for example, thinking of a system requires you to accept that you don't have control. And as a government policymaker, when you've got people clamouring, and mostly with, I would say, a sort of hero leadership model in their heads, which is, you need to fix this for me. How is it that I am suffering? Come on, come and sort this out. You person in government, you've got power, you need to fix it for me. That is the general narrative we are operating in all the time. So you have to step, in order to think in a systemic way, you have to step out of that and go, okay, I don't have complete control. And as Ottoline was saying, I'm going to have to work in uncertainty where I can't control and do trials and tests and so on.
Thanks. I mean, Ottoline, I don't know if you want to sort of comment on Emily's responses and how you think when so much of the context for sort of political action seems to work against the idea of working at in a systems-like way, how likely do you think that you are to be happy that things are moving and continue to move in the direction you think is sensible?
Yes, so I absolutely agree with a huge amount of what Emily said. And it's the big imperatives that bring people together that allow one to break through some of these siloing problems across government. I agree, it's much easier to do it than between departments, which is notoriously hard. I think there are two things in particular that I would like to pick out. One, I guess, folds back a little bit to what I said about public narratives about what government is supposed to do, and vice versa. It's quite deep culturally at the moment that in times of anxiety, I think people tend to retrench and look for someone else to blame. It's one of the ways to cope. It's somebody else's fault, they'll fix it for me. And I think that demand for things to get fixed for me, whilst on the one hand is a perfectly healthy thing to do in a democracy. On the other hand, I think we need somehow or other to get back to some sense of collective responsibility. A lot of the things that people want to be fixed for them, they themselves have quite significant agency in fixing for themselves. And somehow or other, people need to find ways to support people to take back that personal responsibility rather than simply kind of exercising their democratic responsibility to feed into the government system. And we need to think more broadly about collective responsibility as a country, I think. So that's one point. And then a more nitty-gritty point is, I mean, how we help people to think about systems, I think, is something I've been thinking about actually in the context of being a developmental biologist, because developmental biology it's got all the same issues. It's a multi-scale problem with dynamical systems that, you know, takes a single cell into a complex multicellular organism. And it's a very exciting set of questions. And we have come to the point now that we understand enough about what's going on that these kind of complex dynamical models are absolutely fundamental to understanding how it works and also to designing good experiments, which are effectively interventions in the system with predictive outcomes to see whether our understanding of the system works right or not. And the field is having a hard time shifting to thinking in those terms. And I've become very interested in whether we can kind of map what we know about how people think well, which is to do with parts and how they relate to one another, rather than thinking about physical parts, think about dynamical parts, think about types of switch, for example, and how they work. If we can create a sort of parts list at that level, in the dynamical properties level, maybe we can begin to develop a narrative or a conversation that allows us to talk about those things in a way that we understand more intuitively than we do at the moment. So I'm been quite interested in that. And that's hard enough in biology. It's going to be quite hard in policy, but I think it's worth thinking about.
Teresa, it'd be very interesting to hear your views as a behavioural scientist.
My work is about looking at trying to isolate the effect of one cue, changing that with a view to that shifting what happens in a system. So I wouldn't want us to lose sight of the powerful impact of modelling environments that, in this context, food environments, that are healthier and more sustainable, which is where I think that there is a real potential for public sector environments. So let's take healthcare settings. So there's only been one study on this. We're hoping to replicate it, conducted in the US in pediatric outpatient clinics. And what they did was they looked at the perceptions of parents attending with children of the healthiness of a burger that was on sale in some of the hospitals, but not in others, and where McDonald's and other outlets were present in the hospital, then the parents were rating those foods as healthier. So for me, what that says is that there is a signalling effect from having certain foods. So that's just sort of one example of a less healthy food, but there could be sustainable food. So I think the trick is we have to think systemically, as well as thinking along some of the chains, as well as evaluating how a change in the system might have a perturbation that might have negative as well as positive feedback loops. So I think that's all I would say.
Thank you. So, Teresa, I don't know, we're now just about time. Do you want to say any closing remark?
I just wanted to use the words that Ottolien used, which I think really cover certainly much what I've said, as well as what she's said, but from slightly different perspectives, which is about enabling the right thing to happen. So I've tried to talk about food environments that will enable people to have diets that sustain their health as well as the planet. And policy, I see as can be an effective tool alongside many others to enable those environments in order to enable what I think would be a common goal of us all being healthier and living on a planet that's healthier.
Thank you all for taking the time to join us today. And to our listeners, thanks for listening. CSAP's Science and Policy Podcast will be returning for a second season on the 2nd of October. For more information about our upcoming second season, please follow us on Twitter at CSIPOL, where we'll be sharing more information over the coming days.
CSAP Science and Policy Podcast is a production of the Center for Science and Policy at the University of Cambridge. This episode was hosted by Dr. Rob Doubleday and was produced by me, Kate McNeil. Our guests this week were Emily Miles, Professor Dame Teresa Marto, and Professor Dame Ottolien Leiser. You can learn more about CSAP's work by visiting us on Twitter at CSIPOL, or by visiting our website at www.csap.cam.ac.uk. If you have feedback about this episode or questions you'd like us to address in a future week, please email inquiries@csap.cam.ac.uk. And please stay tuned for more information about our upcoming second season. Thanks for listening.